Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, our weekly 22-minute mix of science interviews and music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. This week, a newly discovered comet, parking lot rage, NASA's Voyager spacecraft, and the science behind people's fascination with gory details. Here's a scientist soundbite.
It's always been a part of the human experience to experience violence vicariously as a form of stimulation, as a form of entertainment.
That was University of California professor of psychology Jeffrey Kotler on why some people are fascinated by blood and gore. We'll have more with him later. But first, Voyager, the NASA mission to explore the outer limits of our solar system, has left what scientists call our space bubble. Here to speak with us by phone is Ed Stone, who since 1972 has been project scientist for the Voyager mission. Welcome, Dr. Stone.
Good to be with you.
Now, something is close to escaping the space bubble of our star system. Tell us about what that is.
Well, the sun has a wind blowing outward from it radially at a million miles per hour, and it creates a giant bubble around the solar system. All the planets are inside the bubble, and all the spacecraft are inside the bubble. But Voyager 1 is now 11 billion miles from the sun and is very near the edge of the bubble, which is the edge of interstellar space.
So what do scientists know about the heliosphere, this bubble that surrounds our solar system?
We now know for the first time roughly how large it is. That is, there is a shock which occurs when the supersonic solar wind slows down as it approaches the edge of the bubble. Voyager 1 crossed that shock 6 years ago, and Voyager 2 crossed the shock about 3 years ago. So we now know that the bubble is on the order of perhaps 12 billion miles in radius in the direction we're headed, and Voyager 1 may have on the order of a billion miles or so left to go. It's now 11 billion miles from the sun.
These Voyager spacecraft, it's been over 33 years since the first Voyager launched. For people not familiar with what the Voyager mission is, looking back, Dr. Stone, what do you think is important for people to know about what Voyager has done so far?
Voyager was designed to fly by the four giant outer planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. That's a possibility every 176 years to do that. And 1977, when we launched, was one such possibility. And what we discovered was how diverse the bodies are in the solar system. Before Voyager, the only active volcanoes we knew were here on Earth. After Voyager, we know that there's a moon of Jupiter, which has 10 times more volcanic activity than Earth. Before Voyager, we thought that the magnetic field poles were always near the rotation axis, as they are here on Earth. After Voyager, we now know that, in fact, you can have a magnetic pole down near the equator as well, because that's the case for Uranus and Neptune. Also, before Voyager, we thought that only the Earth had a substantial nitrogen atmosphere. We now know that Titan, a moon of Saturn, has such an atmosphere, although it's much colder, and there's no oxygen in that atmosphere. But time after time, we discovered things that we didn't even know were there to be discovered and have revealed how diverse the bodies are in the solar system.
Looking beyond 12 billion miles from Earth, when the Voyagers pop free of our star's space bubble, what do you think they'll find?
Well, we know roughly outside what's out there because we have some astronomy data, but it really tells us what's out there much further away. What we will find out is what's really right around our bubble. We do know that it's likely to be a cloud of material which was ejected by this explosion of several supernovae 5 to 10 million years ago, and they shed most of their mass, and we are now enveloped in one of the clouds that came from that series of explosions 5 to 10 million years ago.
That was Ed Stone, a professor of physics at Caltech and project scientist for NASA's Voyager mission. And we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science.
Been around this place before. The same as thought it would. Every mind is getting clear. Before I leave the days gone by. Bye.
Find us as EarthSky on Facebook, EarthSky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. Ryan Britton brings us another weird science story. Ryan, how's it going?
Pretty good. How are you?
Doing well.
Well, this week I found a story that really piqued my interest. It's about parking spaces in big parking lots and our territorial instincts to defend them, even though, you know, these parking spots don't necessarily belong to us.
Yeah, these parking lots can be a jungle out there.
They can. And a group of three studies called Territorial Defense in Parking Lots, Retaliation Against Waiting Drivers. These studies begin to quantify our feelings, the feelings that most of us have in parking lots, that our parking space is for our car. You know, it's our space.
Parking lot drama.
Right. And so the first study, what they did was they timed drivers getting into their cars. These were drivers that were about to leave their parking lot space. And if they saw someone who was waiting for their car, their spot, the driver that was leaving would take 7 seconds longer on average to leave than if nobody was waiting.
So science shows that people can park like jerks.
Well, you know, it could also mean that we're distracted by a waiting driver. But in the second study, the level of intrusion, what the researchers call intrusion, it went way up. The researchers had a driver waiting for the space and honking and acting like a jerk. Then, obviously, the driver that's leaving took a lot longer, like 20 seconds longer.
Yeah, kind of like taking an extra sip of coffee before shifting into reverse.
Right, right. And the third and final study of was a survey of leaving drivers and how they felt about drivers who were waiting for them, you know, waiting to take their parking space. As you would imagine, if the waiting driver is a jerk, you know, you bet that leaving driver will take their own sweet time. They knew exactly what they were doing. Take that extra sip of coffee, as you mentioned. But if the waiting driver is being nice and patient, the leaving drivers actually think that they're taking less time, even though, you know, the stopwatch says that they're taking more.
So the people pulling out could be distracted by the people that are waiting.
Right, exactly. So, you know, if you're waiting for a space, the trick is to be as nice as possible to the leaving driver, you know, while still, you know, I would say position yourself to claim the space from other waiting drivers. That way you'll wait less.
I'm wondering if there are any fender benders or broken windows resulting from this study.
Well, not that I'm aware of, but I'm sure there had to have been a few door dings associated.
Ryan, where can people find out more about these parking lot studies?
Well, there's a great write-up recently at the Neurotic Physiology blog at scientopia.org. And the published article is available at the Journal of Applied Psychology at apa.org.
Weird Science with Ryan Britton. Thanks, Ryan.
Sure.
And we're at Sky, a clear voice for science. We'd love to hear from you on Facebook. Tell us where you're from. Find us as Earth Sky. Beth Lebwohl joins us now to talk about the science behind people's fascination with the morbid. Welcome, Beth.
Hey, thank you, Jorge.
So tell us about the scientist that you interviewed.
I spoke to Jeffrey Kotler, who is a professor of counseling at the University of California, Fullerton, but he's also author of a book that was released in late 2010 called Lust for Blood: Why We Are Fascinated by Death, Murder, Horror, and Violence. And so the first thing I asked him was, is it a given that we are fascinated by those things as sort of a human race? And he said, yes.
Since the beginning of human history, you know, you go back to Aztec times with, you know, public sacrifices where thousands of people were murdered in a day, to the delight of audiences, or certainly during the Roman times of the gladiators, where the emperors kept their power largely based on what kinds of spectacles they could put together. Sometimes tens of thousands of people killed for the entertainment of the masses. To, you know, contemporary, all the violent sports that we have today with ultimate fighting and football and hockey and so, yes, it's always been a part of the human experience to experience violence vicariously as a form of stimulation, as a form of entertainment.
And then I asked him, if it's a given that we're fascinated by violence and gore, what's the reason for that? Is there a scientific explanation? And he connected it to, among other things, our biological ancestry.
So why does a relatively nonviolent person enjoy this kind of stimulation? The answer is really complicated, that there isn't really one reason. There's a lot of different reasons that begin with, our own biological evolution, that we're all the products of the most violent people who ever walked the face of the earth. You know, our ancestors were the best fighters and those that were most successful in violence. And that's why we exist today. And we all have within us the remnants of this capacity to respond violently to conflict or to confusion or to fear. And we hold this within us, and yet it's no longer very functional in contemporary life. You know, rarely do we come across a warring tribe attacking us. So we need outlets for this. We need ways to experience and express the violence.
So Beth, that was a long time ago. What about today? What did Dr. Kotler find to support this idea that we're kind of hardwired to be fascinated with violence?
Well, I think it's important to understand that I'm not sure that Dr. Kotler was really coming out on one side or the other. He said that there's just so much research on it, but there's so much conflicting research, and the jury's essentially still out. And he says that because it's a somewhat taboo subject, he really wanted to engage the public in discussions about violence with this book, because in his mind, the better we understand violence, the better job we can do at preventing violence, which he said is the ultimate goal of his own research. And in this next clip, he talks about how, in some ways, our fascination with violence, it's a functional and self-protective mechanism. So here we go.
Some of these different things play out in different ways. For example, you know, just yesterday I'm driving down the freeway and, you know, this is something that everyone sees and people don't really understand. All of a sudden traffic stops and you takes a half hour to get past the spot. And then you realize there was an accident on the other side of the road. There's nothing blocking the road. So why are there rubberneckers? What are people looking at? And there's actually highly functional aspects of our behavior that we're fascinated to find out how people died, what happened, so we can protect ourselves from a similar fate. So in some sense, I wasn't out to look at entertainment violence as necessarily a bad or a good thing, because it can be bad or can be good. But I think the overarching theme that I learned from the experience is just how normal and natural it is to gravitate and be attracted to enjoying and watching different forms of violence, and how that can serve an important part of our lives if it doesn't get out of control and if it doesn't activate us in a way that we become more aggressive or more abusive in our own behavior.
So Beth, what should people listening take away from Dr. Kotler's interview on fascination with blood and gore?
Well, I think what Dr. Kotler kept underscoring, to me at least, was that this preoccupation with violence, death, horror is pretty darn normal. So if you like watching boxing, if you like scary movies and slasher films and are totally into zombies, it's actually normal, unless you are, you know, doing this stuff for many, many hours a day and it's sort of activating you to commit acts of violence. That is not healthy. But just being drawn to it and sort of interested and fascinated, actually, it's what he terms as normal behavior.
Well, thanks, Beth.
Hey, thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Beth Lebwohl, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Earth Sky heard on 1,200 stations around the world. Deborah Bird joins us now to talk about something exciting in the global night sky, the truth about Comet Elenin. Welcome, Deborah.
Hi, Jorge. This is a comet that was discovered in December of 2010. And Comet Elenin, it was discovered by a Russian guy whose last name is Elenin. So comets are named for its discoverer. So that's how it got this name. Somehow this comet has come to be associated with doomsday scenarios. So if you look up Elenin, which is E-L-E-N-I-N, if you look up Elenin on the internet, you're going to find all this stuff about this comet and prophecies of Nostradamus and the Mayan calendar in 2012 and all of these, supposed doomsday scenarios.
Will the world end in 2012 because of Comet Elenin?
Very doubtful. Comet Elenin is one of perhaps millions of objects that are in the very far reaches of the outer solar system in what's called the Oort cloud. And that cloud has been known for many decades now. And when comets are seen coming into the inner solar system, we know that they're, somehow a passing star. At the far reaches of the solar system, somehow jars an object out of that Oort cloud and sends it plunging toward the sun. And what will happen is that the comet will round the sun and eventually head back out to the outer solar system on an orbit that's many thousands of years long. So Comet Elenin is a member of our solar system. There have been many comets like Elenin that have passed Earth in the past. In fact, we usually see a comet like this that becomes bright enough to see with the eye about once every 10 years. So everything's okay.
Yeah, I find the science behind the comet much more fascinating than the prophecies. And what do scientists know right now? You said that this comet was recently discovered. What do scientists know about it?
Well, we know it came from the outer solar system. We know its orbit is thousands of years long. We know that we have not seen this comet before, so it's new to us. And in that situation, astronomers refer to the comet as a young comet. So it's not a comet that's in a close orbit around the sun. It does orbit the sun, but it only encounters the sun every few thousand years. So it's a different type of object than the comets that orbit closer in, which, of course, there are dozens of those, and astronomers are studying those continuously. But this object is of interest to astronomers because it has a fresher surface. Its surface hasn't been affected by the solar wind and by radiation from the sun. So astronomers will be studying it.
So what should we on Earth here expect from Comet Elenin in the months ahead?
Well, Comet Elenin is going to get closest to Earth in October of 2011. And when I say closest, I mean 22 million miles or 35 million kilometers away. So that's about 100 times the moon's distance. So this is a tiny little comet. It's probably got a nucleus maybe about a mile or a kilometer across. Comets are very small objects in contrast to the moon. So 100 times farther than the moon, much, much smaller than the moon. Some of the prophecies and predictions that people talk about have to do with things like altering the tides or even causing the continents on Earth to shift in a strange way. And there's no reason to think that any of that will happen, and no one is expecting that to happen. There's another idea that Comet Elenin might somehow be affected by an outside force and eventually collide with the Earth. But again, no evidence that there is any outside force that could affect the comet in that way, and astronomers are not worried.
What will Comet Elenin look like? Will people be able to see it?
Well, it's really cool when one of these long-period comets comes into the inner solar system because their surfaces have not been as affected as the comets that are closer to the sun. So there's a lot of volatile material on the surface of one of these comets. So there's the potential for a comet like this, as it comes close to the sun, to develop a really long tail and to get really bright. There's not really the thought at this point that that's going to happen with Comet Elenin. It may not even become visible to the eye, but there's still the chance of that. So we've got our fingers crossed on that.
And we have more on this as we're following Comet Elenin and its close approach to Earth later in October 2011.
That's right, at earthsky.org.
Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky is Deborah Bird with the Global Night Sky. And that's our show. Thanks for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. And special thanks this week to our musical contributors, Mother Falcon, The Black and White Years, Wire Tree, and The Sour Notes. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much heart, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age.